Welcome to The Road to Accountable AI. I'm Kevin Werbach, professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. For decades, I've studied emerging technologies from broadband to blockchain. Today, artificial intelligence promises to transform our world. But AI won't reach its potential without accountability, mechanisms to ensure it's deployed in responsible, safe, and trustworthy ways. On this podcast, I speak with the experts leading the charge for accountable AI. Reid Blackman is the founder of the digital ethical risk consulting firm Virtue. He's worked with many different organizations around AI ethics programs and related activities. He's the author of the book Ethical Machines and hosts a podcast by the same name. Both are terrific resources for anyone who's interested in responsible AI or AI ethics. As you'll see in our conversation, Reid has some strong views about those terms and which one makes the most sense to use, and some really fascinating perspectives on just what it means for companies to implement ethical AI programs and what are some of the choices that they have to make and how they should make those choices effectively. I'm sure you'll enjoy my conversation with Reid Blackman. Reid, welcome to The Road to Accountable AI.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into this field of AI ethics, because relatively speaking, you've been doing it for quite some time.
That's good. Relatively speaking, I've been doing it forever. There's sort of a grander story, I suppose, but to sort of keep it brief, I was a philosophy professor specializing in ethics. I had the idea for an ethics consulting company many, many years ago. I didn't see any kind of market for it. Fast forward, I heard some things. I thought, okay, maybe there's a market for this actually. And so I left academia and I started an ethics consulting company with the intention of making it focus on emerging technologies and perhaps AI in particular. I didn't know how quickly the AI space would grow. Thankfully, it grew quite quickly. And so I started advising and consulting on how to do AI responsibly, ethically, not negligently. That's the goal here.
What is the academic training philosophy bring you in this kind of applied field?
Well, before people called it responsible AI, they called it AI ethics. We're talking about the ethical implications of AI, ethical, reputational, regulatory, and legal risks. If you want to know something about AI ethics, you better know something about AI, and you better know something about ethics. And I know a bunch about ethics. That's what the PhD and the 10 years of being a professor and the whatever it was, 15 plus years of academic research and publishing do. So when people make certain kinds of claims about responsible AI or AI ethics, frankly, a lot of times they just don't have a good grip on the ethics of things. And so they say things that are false, misleading, will lead them down wrong paths. And so having that kind of experience, understanding, frankly, expertise under my belt means that I can navigate the conversation really well. I'll give you one quick story to sort of put some meat on the bones of that. When I was really just early transitioning from academic life to, you know, my own company, I joined IEEE, that's the Standardizing Organization for Engineers, because they were working on this project called Ethically Aligned Design. And it was about how do we align, what do they call it, autonomous and intelligent systems with our human values or something along those lines. And I got myself onto this committee that was in charge of figuring out what are the guidelines or what's the advice around research and design of AI from an ethics perspective. And I got on the first call and I was anticipating not being able to say anything because I thought, these are all a bunch of engineers. I don't really know anything about AI. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a mathematician. I'm an ethicist. So I expected it to be a sort of meeting in which I just sat back and listened to the experts. What I learned within the first few minutes is, oh, this isn't some advanced engineering discussion. This is first semester, first year students talking about ethics. They don't know anything. They're engineers. What wound up happening to my sort of amazement is I wound up essentially leading the entire conversation, just leading because they were just saying things that, you know, my first year, first semester undergraduates used to say about ethics. And they were just fundamentally confused. And so I went in there and I sort of led the conversation and had to clear up a number of confusions, answer a bunch of questions, direct the discussion in a way that would actually be fruitful. And so it turns out that it's really the ethics expertise that's more useful than the AI expertise in a lot of these conversations.
Well, you know, not necessarily from that specific example, but what are some misunderstandings that people tend to have if they don't have some real background in ethics?
Well, one would explain, I think, the transition from talking about AI ethics, as was the standard, to talking about responsible AI, as has become the standard among corporations. they just don't know what the heck to do with ethics. The number one misconception, which, and this is, I opened my book, Ethical Machines, with this, is they just think it's squishy, it's subjective, it's just a matter of opinion, it's how you feel about stuff. And if you think of ethics as just how you feel about stuff, you know, I like chocolate, you prefer vanilla. I like genocide, you prefer peace. You know, if we think of it along those ways, then of course you're not going to get your way to actionable steps to identifying and mitigating the risks. So unless you think about ethics as something that's more just touchy-feely stuff, you're not going to actually get your way to designing a framework, designing policy, designing procedures, designing metrics, designing training. You know, otherwise you just tell everyone to consult how they feel about stuff. That's silly. And so getting rid of that misconception, articulating that ethics is or at least can be conceived of as being perfectly objective, and that there are ways of doing ethical inquiry that are responsible versus irresponsible, that there are ways of articulating it in concrete ways that lead to action, that's a phenomenally useful perspective that most people simply don't have.
Let me just play devil's advocate a little bit more, though. People talk about responsible AI, but nowadays people also talk about things like AI governance or AI risk management or AI safety, which are all terms that don't necessarily have that kind of ethical loading. Do you think that's misguided? Should we still be talking about ethics, or are these different things?
So I've argued, this is a point I make in my book, that we just shouldn't use the term responsible AI, that the term responsible AI is a term that was invented by corporates, essentially, so they don't have to say the word ethics because they don't know what to do with it. Incidentally, this is in line with some advice that I got early on when I was still a professor. I was talking to an executive at Starbucks, and she said, not unreasonably, you might not want to say that you're doing ethics consulting. People don't like the word ethics. They don't get it. And I said, no, I'm just going to own the word ethics then. If that's the answer, I'm just going to own the word ethics. And I changed it, incidentally, to ethical risk because I thought risk was a language that businesses understand. Now, look, there's no principled reason to oppose the term responsible AI. It's not as though that's completely bonkers from a ethical or a conceptual perspective. That's reasonable. I think, though, this has been my experience, that what happens when people use the term responsible AI in practice is that they throw in ethics-y stuff into the responsible AI bucket, but then they throw a bunch of other stuff in as well. So they'll say, yes, responsible AI is ethics and safety and regulatory compliance and engineering excellence and cybersecurity. So it's just all the stuff. And then what happens is they say, okay, now let's address the responsible AI bucket. And then the experts in the room are experts on things like engineering excellence and cybersecurity and regulatory compliance. And so what do? They prioritize all of those things to the exclusion of talking about the ethics stuff. And so I think that they miss out on huge swaths of risk because they've decided, let's just, you know, we're focused on responsible AI now and these things within those buckets. And so I think, again, while in principle there's nothing wrong with it, pragmatically or in practice, what happens is that ethical risks get pushed to the sidelines.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I'm a professor of legal studies and business ethics, and we have, for a long time, had a lot of the same conversations more broadly in terms of, you know, what does it mean? How should we talk about it? You know, what's more effective practically in terms of getting businesses to change their behaviors? Do you think these conversations that we're having about AI are really just a microcosm of the larger issues for business, or are there some things about AI that are really distinctive in these discussions?
So it's a little bit of both. I think that one reason why the ethical risks of AI are much discussed is because it's of the nature of the beast that is AI, machine learning, that certain kinds of risks are quite likely to be realized, despite the best intentions, in some cases, of the people designing the AI. So we get things like biased AI and black box AI, we get privacy violations, and those kinds of ethical breaches are not usually the result of bad actors, of bad apples. And so since we've got this powerful new tool, people want to use it for innovation, to drive revenue, to drive internal efficiency, et cetera. But it comes with these associated risks. We naturally get this kind of conversation around risks. I also think that there's probably some contingent story to be told about why people are paying particular attention to this technology in ways that people don't pay attention to ethical breaches by corporations more generally in a way. So perhaps there's some story to be told about how the people in the technological space, they tend to be younger, they tend to be more activist-y, And so you get those, you know, you get the overlapping diagram of being a technologist and being sort of, you know, activist-y, social media active, social justice warrior. And since you get that overlap of the Venn diagram, you get, as a matter of sort of historical contingent fact, lots of attention on the ethical impacts of AI.
Yeah, it's interesting. And obviously, we've seen a lot of evolution in terms of adoption of AI and awareness of AI in the last several years. Have the kinds of questions that companies ask you or the things that they bring you in for changed?
I wouldn't say that they've changed radically. I think the frequency with which the conversations are had, the frequency with which people want help with the sort of thing has increased over the years. There are certain kinds of risks that have popped up very high on the radar as of late, specifically since ChatGPT came out. Very much increased concerns around cybersecurity or the security integrity of their data. That's been a major issue, of course. And then, of course, the hallucination issue that ChatGPT or other models will output just false statements. So I think, you know, if I said, you know, what are the big risks that have come out lately, it'd be the cyber risks and the hallucination risks. The bias risks that are associated with generative AI, those have been around since we've been talking about AI ethics at all. So that's not really new, but it's perhaps exacerbated or especially now that it comes in visual form, it's captured the imagination of people a bit more. But nothing has fundamentally changed, I don't think. It's just awareness has grown.
So in terms of generative AI, you mentioned the hallucination potential. How should we think about that from an ethics standpoint?
The hallucination problem is a problem both for the technologists technologists and for ethicists, right? So one, everyone wants accurate AI. Nobody wants things that are said that are false. That makes it useless. Right? So one, there's just a sort of straight up technical problem. It only veers into the lane of the ethicist when it's giving outputs that are ethically significant or can have an impact on, say, the livelihood of people. So if it's hallucinating about where you should put your money, let's say it's acting as a financial advisor, or it's hallucinating about what the appropriate diagnosis is, or it's hallucinating about whether you can combine these two kinds of drugs when you're asking about your prescriptions or something along those lines, then the ethical impacts are serious. So there's a way in which, you know, I think about the ethics of hallucinations. I think this is something like akin to the ethics of bridge building. You know, when you build a bridge, you don't want the thing to fall apart. Otherwise, it would be a useless bridge. Of course, if it falls apart, if the technical aspects are all out of whack, then so too will the ethical impacts be out of whack, because then people will be on the bridge and it'll collapse and they'll die. So that's really ethically bad. But it's really fine. It's not, if you like, an ethical problem as such to solve. It's more like there's these quasi-technical problems, like outputting false information, that has or can have serious ethical impacts.
But there are these questions with generative AI about what's the appropriate response, what might be toxic or improper or culturally insensitive or biased in ways where reasonable minds can differ.
Sure.
So,
yep.
You know, if a company, brings you in to figure those things out, you know, how would you advise them?
So there's a couple things to say here. I mean, the first thing to say is that usually my company is not brought in at that really granular level of, we've got this particular model for this particular use case, and we want to know what are the standards that should govern this particular model. That happens sometimes. It's starting to come up a little bit more precisely because of particular applications of LLMs for exactly the reasons that you've just stated. Usually what they're looking for is how do we get our organizational hands around this more generally? So how do we create policy around this kind of thing? How do we create the procedures and augment existing workflows for our, say, data scientists and product managers to look for these kinds of risks, to flag these kinds of things? How do we put together the appropriate risk board or committee so that there's someone to whom they can elevate those kinds of concerns? How do we create the grounds on which that committee is going to make decisions about what the appropriate benchmarks are for sufficiently safe or sufficiently appropriate, something along those lines? As for how those substantive decisions get made, there's roughly two kinds of tools that I like to reference. One is an ethics statement or an AI ethics statement. People are going to call them responsible AI statements. Those are really, if you like, high-level articulations of values connected to guardrails of action. So because we value privacy, we'll never do X. We'll never sell your data to a third party. Because we value accountability, we will integrate people's compliance with our AI ethics program into their performance reviews. We'll put ownership of the AI ethics program in the hands of a C-suite executive, that sort of thing. So there's those high-level policies that are I'll give you one more. Because we value justice or fairness, we will vet our AI models for bias at each and every stage of the AI lifecycle. So these are sort of commitments of action tied to values that get at least some procedural guardrails in place and some substantive actions that are ruled out. After that, I mean, even getting that is a big deal, and implementing those procedures, that's a big deal. So forget about, you know, as a former academic, and you want to deal with those really tough cases. Let's deal with these really tough cases where there's a lot of gray area. How do we decide what's appropriate for this LLM? But the truth is, and I would love for most of my customers and my clients to be like, yeah, let's help us with these really hard, tough gray area cases. But that's not where their heads are. Their heads are, that's running. Gray area cases is running. We're just learning how to walk here. We're barely crawling at the moment. How can we crawl safely without like falling off the table? And so, sorry, I'm going on a bit of a ramble. So one is there are those kinds of conversations about really concrete models and what constitutes appropriate. One thing to do is to have general kinds of policies. The second thing to do is to have what I call ethical case law. So this is when you articulate certain kinds of cases that you would say this would be inappropriate, this would be not appropriate. Sort of get internal alignment on those being what I like to call the ethical nightmares. And then when you have a particular novel case, like should it be allowed to say X to Y, let's say something with a certain political content to a general audience, you can compare it to your ethical case law, internal ethical case law, and see whether that provides sufficient guidance. And then, of course, there's going to be deliberation among the ethics board or the risk committee or whatever. The thing that I was backing up to say too soon, I sort of interrupted myself, is the truth of the matter is, while the hard cases are sexy and they're interesting, especially to academics, they are not where most companies are, because most companies are dealing with the not crazy gray cases. You know, maybe an OpenAI is dealing with those gray cases, a Google, a Microsoft, but a financial services company, insurance industry, healthcare and life sciences, food and beverage, apparel, retail, they're not dealing with those crazy situations. They're just hiring people, right? They're using AI software to hire people. How do we not do that in a discriminatory and biased way? So I don't know. This is my sort of, okay, I'm going to stop talking now, but this is my very long-winded way of saying most companies don't deal with those kinds of tough cases.
Yeah, no, that was great. I mean, there was a lot of real good meat in what you put out there. So let me just unpack some of it. If companies are just starting down this path, what's the most important thing for them to do first?
I always like to say that sort of table stakes is a call it a risk assessment or a gap analysis or a AI ethical risk maturity assessment. I think most organizations don't sort of know where they are and what they have in relation to what those risks may be. So looking to see what existing governance structures do we have that cover this sort of thing? What do we lack? What kinds of policies do we have that cover this thing? What policies do we lack? In most cases, if a company has done literally nothing on the responsible AI front, then you might not even need to do that gap analysis, risk assessment, maturity assessment. You know you've got nothing. And now you've got to start with an AI ethics statement, which is going to articulate what those standards are and the procedures that are associated with those standards. And frankly, if you can, the metrics that are associated with those procedures. I like to draw a really clear line from values of a business, or sorry, AI ethical risk values to procedures and the metrics that are used to track compliance and impact of those procedures. So that's a good first step. And then sort of part and parcel of that is then to start building a customized framework. When I say framework, I mean something somewhat specific. It's going to include policies, additional governance structures, governance bodies like an ethics board. It's going to include metrics, might include procedures, might include RACI matrices, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so it's one of the things I really love about your book, Ethical Machines, that, you know, it's rooted in serious ethics, but it's very pragmatic in terms of these kinds of things that you're talking about. But, you know, how much do companies really differ? You're talking about customization, but I think there's probably no company would say, well, our values, we don't care about privacy, or our values are discrimination is okay. So where is it really going to be customized?
There's actually quite a bit of customization to be done. It's actually most of what we do is the customization bit. There are lots of things that vary. So for instance, you're correct. Two different organizations 100 organizations are going to say we value privacy. What that means is going to vary quite a bit across organizations. Some will say, we'll never sell consumer data to a third party. That's part of what our commitment to privacy is. Other companies will say, no, 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 we're going to sell that data. That's what we do. It's a major revenue source for us. So we respect people's privacy, which means we will always ensure that we're going to aggregate and anonymize that data and use various kinds of privacy-preserving techniques like K-anonymity. But that's very different from saying we're not going to sell the data at all. There are differences in what the governance structures have to look like. So look, some organizations are structured like partnerships, and some are, if you like, the sort of the classic pyramid of CEO on top and then everyone below that. When you have an organization that has a sort of like a CEO on top and the CEO says, this is how it goes, this is a gross oversimplification, but more or less, okay, if you got the buy-in of the CEO, that's more or less how it's going to go. If on the other hand, you have say a giant consultancy spread across dozens of markets where there's not that kind of top-down change, because each you need to get buy-in from each of the partnerships, each of the heads of each of the partnerships. Now governance looks totally different because there's not, if you like, one board to rule them all. They might say like, yeah, look, that's good for you guys in the US, but we're over here in the EU. And so we're gonna have to do things a little bit differently over here. Our standards are gonna be different here. Some people want to apply the same risk standards across all markets. So yes, we're in EMEA, we're in the EU, we're in the US, you know, North America, et cetera. And we're going to have the same standards across the board. Others say, no, 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 we're going to have different standards for different markets, different risk thresholds for different markets. We're going to roll this out in different ways. So we're going to roll it out by market, for instance. So first, we're going to roll out this program in the US, then we're going to expand to North America, and then we're going to expand to the EU, and then to EMEA, et cetera. Others say, no, no, we're not going to roll out by market. We're going to roll out by role. So first, we're going to roll it out to all the data scientists. I don't care where geographically they happen to be. And then we're going to roll it out to HR. And then we're going to roll it out to marketing. And that, right, so there's different ways of, well, that's going to be customized. Who's going to sit on the board? What kind of authority does the board have? Can the ethics board be overruled by a more senior executive? Some organizations can say, no, it can't be overruled. That's the final say. Other will say, yeah. It could be overruled by, say, the CEO or something along those lines, or a chief data officer. The chief data officer is not actually on that board. So there's a tremendous amount of what does training look like? We already do risk matrices in our organization. And the way that we do risk assessments is different how our peers do risk assessments. We want responsible AI or AI ethical risk assessments that cohere with, that harmonize or integrate with how we already think about risk in our organization, how we already do those risk assessments. And same with metrics. We want metrics that mirror the kinds of risk metrics that we already have at the enterprise-wide or department level, et cetera. So there's a tremendous amount of customization that needs to be done. That's why, you know, there's like the NIST AI assurance or whatever it's called framework. And it's great. It's super smart. It's totally generic though, necessarily. And so you give that document to, here's a really smart generic framework. And there is a tremendous amount of work left to be done.
But are there right answers to any of those questions? Or is it just a matter of understanding what the organization is and customizing the AI ethics approach to that?
So I think there's reasonable and unreasonable. And I think this is a place where we sort of can think about it in terms of the political spectrum. I think that there are companies who are sort of on the left side of the spectrum, take a Patagonia. There are companies on the right side of the spectrum, take a Hobby Lobby. And we sort of think, yeah, that's fine. In the corporate world, having that, I mean, most anywhere, you think like, having that kind of diversity of values, that's acceptable to us. There's beyond the pale, right? So you don't want KKK values anywhere around. That would be beyond the pale. So when are there right and wrong answers? I think that there are some wrong answers, certainly, but there's lots of right answers that are mutually incompatible. Just like Patagonia's stance on some issue is going to be incompatible with the stance of, say, a Hobby Lobby. That said, there's also right and wrong answers as to, hey, does doing this actually help us to achieve our goals? Is this means sufficient to achieve our end? And then there are certainly right and wrong answers. You know, they'll say, oh, well, we'll just do this. We'll just tell everyone X, and we'll say, that ain't gonna do it. You could. That's not what's gonna happen. You could tell them that, but that will definitely lead to a lot of things falling between the cracks. We highly recommend against that. So I think there's right and wrong and reasonable and unreasonable in the realm of what the values are, what the standards are, what the procedures are. And then there's right and wrong in terms of, are these means sufficient for achieving our ends?
Yeah. So you gave an example of, can the CEO overrule the ethics board? Mm-hmm. How would you help a company think through what the answer is to that?
Well, I mean, it's this. Look, if you really want to take the ethics of this seriously, then you have an ethics board, cross-functional ethics board, well-trained, both in if you like, ethical deliberation on the kinds of issues they're going to face, but also well-trained in understanding, because usually it's this sort of board that's also going to oversee the rollout, compliance, and impact of the program, well-trained in how to oversee a program like this. And if you really want to prioritize ethics and trustworthiness, et cetera, then you say the decision by the ethics committee is the final one. That's it. What they say, if they say this is a no-go, then it's a no-go. And that's really good if you want to prioritize more than, you know, not maybe not more than anything, but very highly prioritize something like long-term trustworthiness of the brand, then you do that. That said, I think we need to be honest here and say there's going to be cases where doing the unethical thing is going to be really profitable. You know, there are sort of AI ethicists out there who say, oh, it's the right thing is also the profitable thing. And sort of like, no, it's, if that were true, we wouldn't have to talk about ethics. We'd be done here because they would already do the profitable thing and then the ethics would fall out of that. So there's clearly conflicts. And so if you say, listen, if you want to give yourself some wiggle room, where, say, bottom line ROI is so great that you think the CEO should have the ability to override the ethics committee, it's not crazy. It's a little bit dangerous in the short term anyway, but it's not a crazy view to hold. In fact, I think in some cases it's quite reasonable to say, you know, yeah, this is a business at the end of the day, and we're willing to take bigger risks. It's going to depend on the context. I mean, there are certainly cases in which CEOs choose the morally abhorrent for some short-term profits. That's a bad thing. But should it be sort of, if you like, structurally disallowed by the organization? Probably not in many cases.
If I'm looking at a company and trying to assess how serious they are, how effective they are in terms of what they're doing on ethics, are there things that I should look for? Are there tells?
In the public realm, no. I mean, if you're asking, I'm looking for it, are you a public citizen sort of poking around their website, or are you
that? Sure. I'm a customer, or I'm someone just trying to evaluate the
company. You're not going to know. You'll have no idea. No clue. The sort of statements that they put out are phenomenally superficial. They're not going to make their policy public. They're usually not going to, you know, when we work with our clients, we train them how to do auditing, how to ready themselves for internal and external auditing of their AI ethics program. And in principle, they can make that stuff public. Number one, most companies are not there yet. They haven't done enough to audit. They're still designing the program. Some are at that audit stage, but most are not. And two, most of them are not going to be public about it. It just puts a target on their back. Early days, this doesn't happen anymore, but five years ago, companies were way more resistant to being public about what they said about AI ethics or ethics generally, because they felt that if we say that we really care about ethics, we're putting a target on our back for journalists to catch us. So if we say we care a lot about AI ethics and then something goes haywire, we're gonna get skewered by the journalists. So let's just shut up about it, keep quiet, and we'll do this stuff internally, but let's not tell everyone about it. That's changed over the last 5 years. Now it's more like, oh, whoa, everyone else is putting out AI ethics statements. We better put out an AI ethics statement to keep up. So that's good, but the statements are by and large phenomenally superficial and mean nothing. The average citizen, they don't know anything. Even if they look at, you know, the privacy policy of the organization, I've seen many examples of paper tigers, many examples where the policy is great and it's not implemented in any way, shape, or form. It's just a beautiful piece of paper that lives in a drive on, you know, drive somewhere in the enterprise, and it's not actually adhered to. So no, you don't know. You can't.
How do you measure success in terms of the work that you do with organizations?
How do I measure success? That's a good question. I mean, you know, if they're just doing the things that we're telling them to do, more or less. I mean, when I say what we tell them to do, we're giving them options. We say, look, you can build your program this way or that way. You know, for instance, we say you can build an AI ethical risk program or responsible AI program, or you can build a digital ethics program. The digital ethics program will include AI, but it's also a bit broader than that to include other kinds of technologies, including ones that are either applications of AI that we don't have yet, new kinds of AI we don't have yet, new kinds of technologies, new applications of new technology. So let's say blockchain, quantum, AR, VR. Ideally, they would all say, oh yeah, digital ethics. It's the broadest, it's the most comprehensive, it's the most proactive way we can address this. These issues aren't going away, they're only growing. So we say, look, digital ethics is ideal. But sometimes they say, listen, would love to do that. We don't have the internal buy-in for that. What we have board support for building an AI ethics program. That's what we're not going to go back to them and say, you know, we want to do something bigger or we want to do something broader. That's where our buy-in is. That's the budget we have. That's where our focus is. That's what our priorities are. So that's what we're going to do. Is that a success or a failure on my view? It's still a success. You know, it's not the ideal, but it's a success. What's another success? If they actually move on to implementation, there are plenty of organizations that will start, they'll write an ethics statement, and then they just stop. That's a failure. You've got to get to the point of implementation. You've got to get to the point of training your people. This is crucial. There's got to be that, if you like, role agnostic training, the training that everyone across the organization gets, then there has to be role specific training. There has to be updates or augmentations of workflows of, say, data scientists, people in HR, et cetera. There has to be documentation. You know, there's got to be all these things where it actually impacts the day-to-day operations. So what we like to say to our clients is, okay, you've done all this, blah, blah, blah. Now you have to get the implementation, because you can write all this stuff. You can have this policy, but that doesn't mean that the data scientist knows what they need to do tomorrow at 9 a.m. when they get to work. This needs to be made clear. And if they don't get to that, that's maybe not yet a failure, but it's not yet a success.
One thing that's changed in this area in recent years has been that there's been an upsurge of regulation and legislation and discussion and passage of things like the AI Act in Europe. How does that impact on what you do or on what companies actually do on the ground? Because, you know, on the one hand, now there's going to be all these requirements. On the other hand, if this just becomes a check the box for compliance, then it might actually be counterproductive. So what do you see?
I think it's too early to tell. It's still TBD. Yeah, there are regulations out there. You know, New York City came out with a regulation not so long ago. I think it passed this past summer that all all AI tools involved in the HR hiring decision-making process need to be audited by a third party. And that's not being enforced. I have no idea if it's had any impact at all. The EU AI Act promises to do more. That's plausible, especially if you're in the EU. Of course, there are lots of companies in the US who operate in the EU, so they'll have to make sure that they're compliant as well. It's going to do something. I think it's just, frankly, it's too early to tell how much of an impact it's going to have. One thing that I anticipate happening could be false. The vast majority of owners of these kinds of problems within organizations are on the C-suite, on the tech side of the house. So a chief data officer, or a chief analytics officer, or sometimes a chief information security officer, or a chief information officer, a chief digital officer, blah, 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 blah. It's the risk and compliance people, not so much involved. We say, look, it's great. We need to bring them to the table. We need them in these conversations. Legal is pretty standard to say, bring them to the table. But usually the risk and compliance people are not spearheading it. So I think operationally, we'll probably see a change where it gets less in the hands of tech people and more in the hands of those risk and compliance people, or at least if not less in the hands of the data people, the risk and compliance people will have to get more involved because that's their job. So I think we'll see more of that. That in principle will be helpful because those chief data officers, what do they know about risk and compliance? They're not risk and compliance folks. They're engineers, they're data scientists. They build cool shit. That's not what they do. And so I think that having, trained risk and compliance people probably owning the program or at least playing a significant role in it will increase adoption. Will it be mere box checking? I don't know. Probably the beginning is my guess. There's also a way in which companies tend to overestimate what they're actually doing. So we'll ask companies, oh, so are you doing X, Y? And, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're checking for bias? Yeah, 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 yeah. We check for bias. And then we sort of start digging around and we find out, oh, not really. I mean, like the thing that they're doing is so minimal. And so there's also a level of self-deception or at least ignorance about how robust what they're doing actually is. So, I'm optimistic, but it's a cautious optimism. I wouldn't be shocked if it turned out to be box checking.
And is there anything else that you see potentially coming in the next few years that's going to have a major impact on AI ethics?
I mean, there's two kinds of things, broadly speaking, that could have the impact. And they're compatible. One is a big disaster. Think of like Cambridge Analytica, but for AI. Right? So if you get that kind of thing, that will help. I mean, you know, that'll be the silver lining. That'll be a cause of people taking it more seriously. That might happen. It wouldn't surprise me. But the other thing is just, you know, death by a thousand cuts. Right? So there's this AI incident, and then this one, and then this one, and then this one, and this one. Neither one of which is a massive crisis, but the aggregate should be terrifying, I think, eventually to people in the C-suite and the board responsible for protecting the brand of their organization. So I just think it's going to be the case that we're seeing increased adoption. And as you get increased adoption, you get increased deployment. And increased deployment means increased probability of things going ethically sideways. And so you get more things going ethically sideways, and they're going to be published, et cetera, et cetera. On that note, by the way, increased adoption, there are some people who say, oh, you know, generative AI, it's been a year already, or it's been a year and 2 months, whatever. And we haven't seen the massive change yet. And I just think, just chill, just hold on. We're talking about the most cutting edge technology out there. They're working on it. They're figuring it out. You know, most of our clients are running dozens, in some cases, hundreds of pilots using generative AI. They're just trying to figure out how this thing works. They're trying to figure out, does it solve a business problem for us? What business problem does it solve? How do we use it responsibly? So, you know, for all the talk about, oh, it's out here, it's played. No, not really. OpenAI released their stuff a year and a bit ago. Google a little bit less than that. Then there's all these other, you know, Llama and Anthropic. Just wait a second. We're going to see, I would, unless things go oddly haywire, we're going to see lots of adoption, lots of deployment in 2024, let alone 2025. And with the increased adoption, we're going to see more bad incidents.
All right. Well, more bad incidents, but hopefully also more good work for people like you.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, you know, this comes against the backdrop of being, I don't know, not a pessimist about the technology. I'm not a catastrophist. I mean, there are some people out there who are screaming that the sky is falling and everyone's going to die. And this is a disaster and it's not ready for prime time and it never will be. I just think that's sort of stupid. I mean, I've seen use cases that work and they do amazing things. There are cases, I was recently talking to an organization yesterday that said they implemented a generative AI solution for certain kinds of search and summarization of a process that used to take 40 hours and now it takes 4. And they're happy with the results. They're happy with the metrics. They're happy with how its level of accuracy. They're happy with the level of risk that there is in the particular use case that it is. Just give it, there'll be more. That's a well-funded, you know, organization who has lots of power to throw out these kinds of problems. Others don't have that kind of power or they're slower. They want to see what others are doing. But yeah, I'm not a catastrophist. I think that there's tremendous good opportunity. And yeah, there's lots of opportunity though to make sure for people like me to help organizations make sure they don't go off the rails.
Reid, thanks so much for this conversation. It's been really instructive and fascinating.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This has been The Road to Accountable AI. If you like what you're hearing, please give us a good review and check out my Substack for more insights on AI accountability. Thank you for listening.